Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar Eltaray, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What's on our agenda today?
It's 2Q REIT earnings recap. And as we're recording on the 31st of July, we're at the midpoint of REIT earnings releases for the second quarter of 2025. And on this episode, we just want to give you a snapshot what many of the REITs have been reporting out to their investors and to the market. So we have a selection of REITs that we don't typically cover when we do this quarterly update. But if you think about this episode as part one of a two-part series, that's probably the best way to approach it. In our next episode, we'll fill you in on some of the key themes from the second half of these calls when we have a better view of how the companies and their properties are performing across pretty much all the sectors. But with that little intro, Cole, how about we jump right in?
Yeah, sounds good. I think the best place to start is probably where the calls themselves typically start, which is with industrial. And we do typically cover Prologis, so I don't want to go back on what you already said about covering things we don't usually cover. But I think this really sets the stage for some of the environment for the industrial calls. Hopefully our listeners are familiar, but if they are not, Prologis is the largest industrial and warehouse landlord in the U.S., more than 1.3 billion square feet globally across 20 countries, 3,000 properties in the U.S., and they have exposure to all the major industrial markets. So the Inland Empire, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, San Francisco. The company is based in San Francisco. So they have 6,500 different tenants. They're largest in the U.S. Amazon, Home Depot, FedEx, DHL, UPS, Walmart. So a lot of your big retailers and third-party logistics providers. And then more recently, companies expanded into data centers and energy infrastructure. A lot of their newer built-to-suit facilities actually have solar. Getting right into the results, they did beat consensus estimates on revenue by 2% and funds from operation at exceeded them by 3.6%. But they did lower corporate guidance, so earnings diluted share attributable to common stockholders to be in the range of $3 to $3.15 compared to previous guidance of $3.45 to $3.70. Now, some other interesting data under the hood, they did see same store NOI growth of 4.9%. But despite this, stock underperformed the all-REIT benchmark by 2.7 percentage points. Strong fundamentals did not really translate into their outperformance because they had a slight disappointment on earnings per share. And there's a lot of macro uncertainty that's weighing on investor sentiment for industrial. So even though they had some good leasing momentum, didn't really make a cut here. But there's also some important CRE drivers that I wanted to call out from the call. They have pretty strong occupancy, 95.1%. According to their benchmark, they are beating the market by 290 basis points. They had 130 million square feet in their leasing pipeline in Q2. That's up 19% on the year. Mark-to-market leases, 22% by the end of Q2. Measure that I've not called out before, but space utilization crossed the 85% mark. So tenants are definitely working through some of their excess capacity. That's up 50 basis points on the quarter. Now, management sees vacancy in their portfolio peaking at around 7.4%. But they see rent growth returning when it dips to 5%. Some other things to call out, inquiries for spaces above 100,000 square feet have ticked up. Their build-to-suit pipeline is huge. It totaled $1.1 billion year to date. That was the highest in company history. They've also got some data center development underway, $300 million for an investment in Austin. They said it was for a top hyperscaler, so one of the large tech companies. Third-party logistics leasing was pretty strong. It was one-third of their activity in the quarter, even as new leasing across their markets was still pretty cautious. So the last thing I want to call out, and this goes into one of the broader themes that we'll be covering, let's say, on next week's episode, but the management commentary was really interesting here in Prologis' call. So their CEO emphasized that, and I like the way he phrased this, that uncertainty has become the norm. So if you were to just look at the last few years across their portfolio, first you had Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you had Fed policy changes, and now you've got this kind of post-Liberation Day tariff volatility that began in April. And he said, despite this, though, a lot of their customers are pushing forward, particularly the large ones, and especially in build-to-suit deals, which are typically, they look at a longer-term horizon than some of these kind of shorter-term volatility. He said that in uncertain times, tenants do often defer decisions. But when two tenants are competing and one loses out, there's this element of the fear of missing out. So you could quickly switch from fear to fear of missing out. And so it does catalyze a lot of leasing velocity when they see this happening. Some other things that were important, and there's been a lot of news stories coming out after this call, but with industrial development starts really low, the industrial development pipeline continues to be depleted. And so they're hopeful about a renewed pricing power. The other thing as well is that replacement costs are way up. And so this, for incumbent owners, this is definitely a good sign. The build-to-suit boom came up more than once. This is the strongest for that segment, at least in the current CEO's career at Prologis. And so especially as 1 million plus square foot facilities are really scarce, this has been a pretty good market for them. Some market commentary, they're seeing some of their U.S. markets in the South rebound after kind of struggling the last year and a half. South Florida, Nashville, and parts of the Midwest were called out. And the management did push back on the idea that the coastal markets are weak as imports continue to drop. They say Southern California might be soft for now, but they're seeing some others remain pretty resilient, like South Florida. So a lot of interesting stuff on that call. Omar, I know you covered an industrial REIT too, one that's presumably quite a bit smaller. Any similar themes there?
Yeah, so I tuned in for First Industrial Realty Trust's second quarter call. And as a reminder, they are, as you noted, they're not as large as Prologis, but still have a pretty substantial footprint. They own, operate, develop, and acquire logistics properties, and so are squarely in that industrial space. They're headquartered in Chicago, Illinois, and their portfolio is about 70.5 million square feet. That's inclusive of their development pipeline. And they're concentrated in 15 major MSAs, really with a focus on coastal supply constrained markets. And this includes Southern California, which is easily its largest market, accounting for about a quarter of total portfolio rental revenue. But they do have also meaningful exposures in central and eastern Pennsylvania, Dallas-Fort Worth area, and Phoenix. And I guess similar to Prologis, they do have a pretty diverse tenant base, but their largest tenants include Amazon, Lowe's, and Ferrero, to name some of the top tenants. But in terms of results, they released their earnings on the 16th, but held their call on the 17th with analysts, and reported FFO, or funds from operation, to the tune of 76 cents per share. That was about 4 percentage points above analyst expectations going into the call, or 3 cents on a per share basis. Net income was $55.2 million for the quarter. And if you looked at the share price reaction or the market reaction, it was generally positive, as the shares outperformed other industrial REITs by about 2.6% immediately following the release of the results. Diving into kind of the CRE drivers for the quarter, for the second quarter, the company reported a year-on-year same-store NOI growth on a cash basis of 8.7%. Same-store occupancy was at 94.7%. That's down from the 95.5% in the first quarter. But overall, the company is, I would say, still performing quite well. And the company started leasing approximately 2.5 million square feet during the quarter. They noted that their cash rental rate increases on both new and renewal leasing was 33% in Q2. And in terms of filling their space, they noted that they've addressed 88% of total 2025 lease expirations by square footage. So even though they're only halfway through the year, they're really addressing any of those leases that are coming to expiration. Right after the quarter end and in July, the company has fully leased its 1.8 million square foot Camelback 303 joint venture project in Phoenix. So that was kind of a notable update that didn't fall in the second quarter, but was worth highlighting on their call. Turning some attention to their development pipeline, the company has started construction on two new spec developments in Dallas and Philadelphia, with a total investment estimated to be around $54 million. Management indicated that to increase new development starts, they really would need to see more consistent development lease signings and more tenant investment in new growth initiatives. So even though they do have an active development pipeline, these were some signs that the management team needs to see before focusing on building that pipeline up more. In terms of acquisitions and dispositions, through the first half of 2025, the First Industrial management team acquired two buildings in Phoenix for a total of $120 million and disposed of two buildings in Detroit for $12 million. On the earnings call, the CEO, Peter Basile, noted that uncertainty around potential tariffs really continues to dampen momentum around tenant decision-making. This echoed the Prologis call. However, with new construction starts at 10-year lows and the availability of Class A space really diminishing, we're getting into a more attractive supply-demand dynamic. The CEO also noted that vacancy in Tier 1 U.S. markets was around 6.3% at the end of the quarter. On their call, they also noted that leasing activity is pretty broad-based, but they did note that there was some pretty strong demand from food and beverage, 3PLs, or third-party logistics, automotive, manufacturing, consumer products, and e-commerce tenants. And they characterized the tenant behavior as varied, with some pausing decisions due to uncertainty, some doing some window shopping, and others actually moving forward to execute their business plans. Management also stated that construction costs are down about 5 to 10% from the second half of 24, but have been relatively flat since the start of 25. And in terms of company guidance, the company did narrow its full year 2025 guidance range for FFO to $2.88 to $2.96 per share, but ultimately kept their midpoint of that range unchanged at $2.92 per share. The outlook is really based on assumptions of average quarter end in-service occupancy being between 95 to 96% and same store NOI growth between 6 and 7% for the year. And the final thing that I would note before turning it back to you, Cole, is that their CFO, Scott Musil, noted that higher interest expense in the second half of the year, which will be driven by development funding and a recent bond offering, will ultimately affect their FFO compared to the second quarter. Just noted that some of their current development work, as well as the company financing costs, will see a flow through into FFO expectations. How about we dive into the hot or interest heavy sectors of office?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to start with one I think a lot of our New York listeners are intimately familiar with, and that's SL Green. So they reported their results on the 17th. But to give a little bit of an overview, they are Manhattan's largest office landlord. They have an interest in 53 buildings covering 30 million square feet, mostly concentrated in the Midtown area. 27 million are square feet in Manhattan buildings themselves, and another 2.7 secures debt and equity investments are theirs. So their largest tenants are among others, Paramount, Bloomberg, UBS, Sony, TD Bank. So a lot of big office tenants. But looking at their results, they actually did beat consensus estimates on both revenue and FFO by fairly large margins, 51% and 19% respectively. They did maintain their guidance for net income for the full year 25 at $1.27 a share to $1.57 a share. However, their stock actually underperformed the broader REIT index by 2.3 percentage points. And why is that? The market really viewed their guidance as a kind of a one-time adjustment driven by some of their investment gains rather than actual office cash flow. And in addition to investors being pretty wary of Midtown leasing velocity. So some of the key CRE drivers that I noted from this call, leasing momentum is fairly strong, 540,000 square feet in Q2. That brings their year-to-date total to 1.3 million square feet. These are mostly mid-sized leases, under 25,000 square feet. Financial services was the largest in that group, but closely followed by legal, TAMI, or tech advertising, media and information, and even nonprofit tenants. Management expects the occupancy to hit 93.2% by the end of the year. In quarter two, it was 91.2%, but they've got a full pipeline, growing tenant demand, even outside their core kind of Park Avenue assets. They say tech leasing is accelerating again in Midtown South, and they've seen some recent deals signed by one of the companies was Pinterest, and they're seeing some interest in the pipeline at their 1 and 11 Madison buildings. Some other notes, they said effective rents are rising, concessions are holding steady. Mark-to-market spreads have been positive in four of the last five quarters. Their redevelopment at 1 Madison is gaining a lot of traction. There's a very tight availability in trophy office space in Midtown, and so it's driving a lot of those renewals. Now, the management commentary on this one was fairly interesting, focused on a couple of big deals that they've got underway. So their CEO, Mark Holliday, pushed back on what was referred to as quarter-to-quarter nitpicking. They're very bullish on New York City fundamentals. Tourism is rebounding. Tax receipts are at near records. And volatility in financial markets is actually beneficial to space for some of those financial tenants. They don't see any hesitation stemming from city politics in the mayoral race. The Democratic primary has just concluded a few weeks ago, and the race is later in November, but they don't see any issues there. One big thing that they're focused on right now is that they are behind one of the casino bids. So folks who are not familiar with this, the legislature here in New York has granted three downstate casino licenses that most of the major developers around in and around the city are vying for, some of the three. And so they just submitted their proposal. It's a 13,000-page document that's 4 years in the making. And it's a Times Square Caesar's Palace casino, and they are very excited about the idea of that catalyzing transformation of Times Square. One of the other things that I wanted to mention, they address some kind of broader supply constraints in their core market. There's only 1 million square feet of new Midtown office space being set to deliver over the next 4 years. Thought that was very carefully worded because I know there are some on that 5 to 6 year horizon that are already in the planning stages, but there are 13.5 million square feet of office conversions citywide, office to residential. And so that is going to tighten the leasing market for office even further. They're hoping pushing rents higher, particularly for some of their big Class A assets. Definitely an interesting call. I suspect a little different than what you heard, Omar. What did you hear about on BXPs?
Yeah, so there was some overlap. Just to do a quick intro to BXP, one of the largest owners, they own, manage, and develop premier workplaces and ultimately office throughout the U.S. They are heavily concentrated in major cities, including Boston, L.A., New York, SF, Seattle, and D.C. And their portfolio is about 167 properties and totals about 50 million square feet. They do have some non-office assets, but for the vast majority of their portfolio is office. And if you look at their contribution to NOI, about 40% of their portfolio NOI is coming from Boston, and then about a quarter is coming from New York, and then 16% from SF. And they do have similar exposure to a wide variety of office tenants, but meaningful portions coming from the tech industry. But ultimately, they reported results on the 30th and then had their call the morning of the 31st, or the day we were recording. And the company reported FFO per share of $1.71, which ultimately blew out the expectation coming into the call and beat the company's own guidance by about 5 cents per share. The outperformance for the quarter was really driven by overall improved portfolio operations. And the company reported a net income of $89 million for the quarter, or about 56 cents per share. And that's about 25% higher than the analyst expectations before the results were released. Looking at their portfolio performance through Q2, BXP's same store portfolio NOI grew by 1.16% on a year-on-year basis. This is down from the 1.62% that they reported last quarter. But I would note that this is still better, so long as it's positive. It's much better than the five-quarter streak that they had reported between the fourth quarter of 2023 all through 2024 of net NOI contractions. Same store occupancy was at 86.8%. That's down about 90 basis points from the prior quarter, but their leased percentage across their portfolio was 89.1% through the second quarter. If you're looking at leasing activity, BXP completed over 1.1 million square feet of leasing in the second quarter, bringing their total for the first half of 2025 up to 2.2 million square feet. The cash rent change on new and renewal leases signed during the quarter was flat overall, but there was some modest increases in both Boston and New York, and some slight decreases along the West Coast markets and DC. Turning some attention to their development activity, the company's total development pipeline was 67% leased at quarter end. This is an increase of about 500 basis points from the prior quarter. And the company announced that it started the full vertical construction of its 930,000 square foot development at 343 Madison Avenue in New York. On the call, they also announced that they've executed a letter of intent with an investment-grade financial institution to really anchor the project. And this institution is expected to lease approximately a third of the building. The 343 Madison development is projected to deliver in late 2029, so we're still a ways out, but will contribute a stabilized, unleveraged cash yield on cost of somewhere between 7.5% and 8%. Management focused on this because they ultimately see this as really a significant value creation opportunity for their shareholders. On the opposite end, in terms of from development and focusing a little bit on dispositions, management noted that they're in various stages of selling 10 non-core or non-income producing assets, including land sites and some vacant buildings, that are expected to generate nearly $300 million in net proceeds over the next 2 years, and that the company is also looking to re-entitle a commercial site in Lexington, Massachusetts for a 312-unit multifamily development with an institutional partner. From the call, if looking at what management was saying and kind of their views on the market, their CEO, Owen Thomas, described the operating environment as really demonstrating a property and capital market recovery being underway. And he noted that BXP's leasing activity remains, quote unquote, vibrant across many submarkets. And this is really driven by renewed corporate confidence and increasing RTO, or return to office, mandates. The management team also noted and emphasized really that premier office or premier workplace is really outperforming the broader market environment. And in BXP's core markets, direct vacancy for their top tier assets is about 7.5 percentage points lower than the overall office market, as well as asking rents are about 50% higher than the broader office market. I thought those were interesting, just rough numbers to get a sense of how divergent the office market situation is. The team also noted that demand on the East Coast is really heavily led by the financial and professional service firms. And you're seeing that play out in their New York and their Boston offices or segments of their portfolio. And then on the West Coast, they are seeing really demand being driven by AI or AI-related companies. Their president, Doug Lind, noted that there are 37 AI-related tenants in the San Francisco market with an aggregate demand of almost 1.2 million square feet. In terms of office sales, sales volume increased significantly in the second quarter to about $14.2 billion, and financing for high-quality assets is increasingly available. So another nugget that I thought is helpful to characterize the overall market. Now, hopping back to the company specifics, the BXP did raise its full-year guidance for FFO by 2 cents per share at the midpoint to a new range of $6.84 to $6.92 per share. This guidance shift was largely attributed to the increase to stronger than expected portfolio performance and overall improved efficiencies across the portfolio, given their lower general and administrative expenses, but was partially offset by higher projected interest expense due to the overall revised outlook for monetary policy and interest rates coming down. And the company projects same store cash NOI to grow by 1.25% for the full year 2025. And finally, on kind of outlooks and outlook commentary, management does expect their current in-service portfolio occupancy to improve to around 87% by year-end 2025. And with limited lease expirations in 2026 and 2027, the company expects to gain occupancy, revenue, and FFO in the coming years. I know that was a lot, but I think office deserves a lot of attention. I'm going to shift the conversation to residential, another hot sector that we've seen a lot of investment activity in throughout the year, as it's kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum and is viewed as one of the safer asset classes. But I tuned into the Verus Residential call. Verus is headquartered in Jersey City, New Jersey, and is really focused on owning, operating, acquiring, and developing premier Class A multifamily properties, primarily in the Northeast region of the U.S. The portfolio that they have is pretty small, but it's 27 properties concentrated in New Jersey, like the New Jersey waterfront submarket and Massachusetts. The New Jersey waterfront submarket contributes about 75% of their overall portfolio NOI. But I think that this company is a great proxy for New York and New York area apartment and multifamily fundamentals. In terms of results, Verus announced its second quarter results on the 23rd of July and held their call on the 24th. The company ultimately reported a beat in terms of FFO, reporting 17 cents per share. That's about 13% higher than consensus going into the release. Net income for the quarter was $10.9 million, or about 12 cents per share. That's well above estimates and was driven by better than expected revenue growth and overall operating margin expansion. The initial share price reaction to the release and to the management call was positive, as the Verus shares outperformed other apartment REITs by about 1.4% immediately following. Looking at their portfolio and the CRE drivers that drove the performance, in looking at their same store metrics, in the second quarter of 2025, Verus reported a 5.6% increase on NOI. That's on a year-on-year basis. They had a blended net rental growth rate of 4.7%, comprised of 5.2% on renewals and 4% on new leases. And same store rental growth was just about 4% on a year-on-year basis. Occupancy did slip slightly to 93.9% from 94.7% in the first quarter of 2025. On July 10th, technically after the quarter ended, but just in time for the earnings release and to be highlighted on the earnings call, the company completed the sale of its Signature Place property for $85 million. And year to date, the company has completed or is under contract for approximately $450 million of non-strategic asset sales at an average cap rate of 5.1%. Also in the second quarter, Veris acquired its partner's 15% interest in the Sables apartment community in Jersey City. The company has a pre-construction pipeline that includes several multifamily, hotel, and retail properties in New Jersey and Massachusetts, but we're not going to dive into that meaningfully on this call. Turning to some of the management commentary and some of the nuggets that came out of that, out of the discussion with analysts and investors, their CEO described the Northeast multifamily market as showing encouraging signs, citing favorable supply and demand dynamics, and highlighted New York City as really one of the strongest markets nationally, with the vacancy below 3% despite new supply coming online. And overall, this supply and demand dynamic really positively impacts Veris's highly concentrated portfolio. Turning attention to and speaking specifically to the Jersey City market, their CEO noted that new construction in Jersey City is concentrated on the Journal Square submarket, which does not directly compete with their portfolio along the Jersey City waterfront, and noted that the waterfront submarket has lower vacancy, about 25% higher asking rents, and overall superior rental growth compared to the Journal Square submarket. One thing that I was pretty surprised by, but maybe I need to dive in deeper to see if this is out of whack, but they did note that their tenant profile across their portfolio has an average household income of over $400,000 and rent-to-income ratio below 11%. These seemed very impressive. They seem to be getting a rather affluent group, and that might check out because they say about 25% of their new move-ins are coming from New York City, which obviously has some of those higher salaries. The company did provide some updates on their guidance for full year 2025, and they now expect core FFO to be in a range of 63 to 64 cents per share. That's up from 61 to 63 cents per share prior. And guidance for same store NOI growth was also raised to a range of 2 to 2.8%. And that's up from 1.7 to 2.7% prior. The revised guidance really reflects the portfolio's strong performance, progress on their asset sales, and companies continue to focus on reducing their overall debt burden. We mentioned that we were focused on some REITs that we don't usually focus on, and Veris is one of those. But taking a step back, staying in the residential space, Cole, what are you hearing from the larger Essex results?
Yeah, you know, Essex is a bit larger, but they are entirely West Coast. And so we're going to get a little bit of a different view with this one. But much like Veris, they do acquire, develop, redevelop, and manage multifamily resi properties, but again, West Coast. So they have ownership interest in 257 properties. They cover 62,000 units. These are mostly stable, institutional quality buildings, highly amenitized. About 25% of properties by count are in LA. Another 18% are in Seattle, 14% in San Francisco, 11% in San Diego. And I don't think there's anything as impressive as the stats that you just gave me about the types of renters that are in Veris's properties. But the key tenancies for Essex are young professional renters by choice. And so these are mostly from wealthy households exceeding $150,000 in household income who could otherwise afford a home in some of these markets, but choose urban living near some major employment nodes and transit. So zooming out to their results, they reported now just yesterday, July 30th, but they barely beat consensus estimates for revenue and FFO. by about 7 cents a share for FFO. But they did have better than expected same property NOI growth, 3%. However, their stock did drop 5% relative to the benchmark and even slid a few percentage points the next day. So they did raise their core FFO guidance by 10 cents a share and beat by 7 cents a share in Q2. However, higher operating expenses and a very cautious outlook about the Los Angeles market did overshadow that guidance raise. So some key CRE drivers here in the call, they saw blended rent growth of 3%. Southern California lagged a bit, actually, at 1.3% in Los Angeles. But Northern California well made up for that. In San Mateo, up 5.6%. San Jose, up 4.4%. On a new lease, like-for-like basis, blending all different types of leases, if you were to include corporate and short-term leases, their rent growth was actually closer to 4% overall. One of the things that came up on this call a lot was the kind of plummeting number of multifamily deliveries that are expected in the back half of the year, expected to decline 35% across Essex's blended markets. And they think that's going to ease a little bit of pressure there. Now, deal volume picked up. Essex has had a few recent Northern California acquisitions that averaged in the mid to high 4% cap rate range, and now are pricing them in the low 4% range. So had some almost immediate NAV accretion there, which I thought was really interesting. Macro commentary on this call revealed a lot too. One of the reasons that they saw major NOI growth in their portfolio was actually that property taxes dropped in the state of Washington, and they've been able to trim some expenses across their portfolio. And then on a kind of a supply note, there have been some California Environmental Quality Act reforms. But Essex is pretty skeptical that those permitting reforms are actually going to translate into new supply because the development economics are not there. So most projects that they're currently underwriting or other folks are currently underwriting in California just don't pencil out without substantial reductions in financing costs. Now, there is a lot of public policy uncertainty on the West Coast, particularly in LA. But one of the things that's really been a boon for them is the explosion in job postings at major tech companies in Northern California. I think they didn't say it explicitly, but I assume a lot of this is AI related, which we've already heard the resurgence in San Francisco story come up a few times. But a couple of the things mentioned on this call, one that I did want to call out was that they do plan to have some select dispositions within the second half of 2025, but almost all of that is going to go right back into new acquisitions. So I think they are fairly bullish on Northern California. I don't know if they commented on that more just because there was some weakness in Los Angeles or if they're really expecting things to turn around in that part of their portfolio, but definitely an interesting call, a little different than Veris, but this is a lot of interesting stuff here, especially as it relates to the kind of West Coast supply story. But Omar, we've got a couple other sectors to cover here. How about we jump straight to retail?
Yeah. So tuned into NetStreet Corp. NetStreet is headquartered in Dallas, Texas, and they're focused on acquiring, owning, managing really single tenant retail properties and is ultimately focusing on the net lease structure with high quality credit tenants. They're invested in around 705 properties, leased to about 106 tenants across 45 states. Their tenant profile, or at least their largest contributors to their portfolio rental revenue, are some pretty well-known big-name retailers, including Dollar General, CVS, Home Depot, and Delhaize Brands, which a bunch of, I would say, regionally recognizable names, including Food Lion, Giant Food, Stop and Shop, et cetera. And Dollar Tree, I would say, is also in that kind of top tenant list. They reported second quarter results on the 23rd of July and then held their call the next day and reported core FFO of 31 cents per share and AFFO of 33 cents per share. That's about 3.1% increase on a year-on-year basis. Overall, they did beat consensus estimates going into the call. And while they beat analyst expectations for the quarter in terms of revenue and EBITDA, they did miss in terms of net income or EPS. Net income for the quarter was $3.3 million or about 4 cents per share. And that's about 30% below the consensus estimate going in. The initial share price reaction to the call was modest. Shares of NetStreet did outperform other retail REITs by about 1%. If you look at their portfolio and some of the CRE drivers, at quarter end, the portfolio's weighted average lease term was a pretty impressive 9.8 years, with only 1.2% of annual base rent really expiring through 2026. The company has been very active in the capital markets, selling 2.8 million shares via its ATM or at the market share program for net proceeds of $46.1 million. In terms of real estate transactions, during the second quarter, the company completed $117 million of gross investments across 32 assets at a blended cash yield of 7.8%. And these assets had a weighted average lease term of 15.7 years. It also sold 20 properties for $60.4 million at a 6.5% blended cash yield. Turning attention to some of management's commentary, their CEO, Mark Manheimer, described the company's tenants as incredibly healthy, with really stability provided by their portfolio's concentration in necessity, discount, and service industries. The management team noted that most of their retail tenants are feeling pretty bullish and are ultimately in growth mode. The company's management team did increase their guidance for full year 2025 for AFFO per share and shifted their range up just 1 cent on both ends of their range. Their new guidance for full year AFFO is $1.29 to $1.31 per share. And I think this was a bit more notable that they raised their 2025 net investment activity guidance to a range of $125 million to $175 million for the full year. That's up from their prior guidance of $75 million to $125 million. Another kind of thing to note is the record high cash yield that they had seen on their investments in the second quarter, and that cash yield was 7.8%. Management doesn't expect this to hold in much longer, and they expect yields to ultimately normalize to a range of 7.4 to 7.5% for really the remainder of the year. Their kind of broad diversified portfolio across nearly all states and touching many large retailers, they do provide a pretty good pulse on, I'd say, like retailer sentiment. But Cole, I know you tuned into another retail call. What were you hearing with Curbline?
Yeah, and I'd say Curbline is fairly similar in that it's net lease, single tenant retail, but the difference is that it's all small format. For folks who've been tuning into the podcast for a while, we've talked about this story before, but Curbline is a spinoff of Site Centers from just around a year ago, but it's mainly focused on convenience properties. So think necessity-based retail, or quick service restaurants, bank branches, wellness clinics. You won't find any large format stuff like Home Depot, like you would in NetStreet's portfolio. But they do have properties in nearly every state, but the top are Florida, Texas, and Georgia, collectively about 40% of their entire portfolio square footage. And the top tenants include Darden Restaurants, Starbucks, Verizon, Jersey Mike, and JP Morgan Chase. So they think of themselves as covering a once overlooked segment of the retail market, and they particularly target high income, high traffic locations. Now, looking at their results, they reported on July 28th, they beat consensus expectations for revenue and FFO. They also updated earnings guidance for 2025. For the year, they expect net income attributable to Curbline of 37 cents a share to 44 cents a share, against previous guidance of 43 cents a share to 50 cents a share. However, despite this adjustment, the stock actually outperformed the benchmark. So investors are pretty excited by some of their long-term prospects for Curbline. They see increasing leasing spreads, and this was actually the company's first post-spinoff dividend. Some key CRE drivers noted on the call, their same property NOI rose 6.2% on the year. Total NOI jumped more than 8% on the quarter. driven by organic growth and acquisitions, but their CapEx remained pretty low, just 7% of NOI, and it supported nearly $25 million in retained cash before distributions. Leasing velocity was at an all-time high. 50,000 square feet of new leases signed in the quarter. That was the highest ever. This pushed the portfolio's occupancy rate to 96.1%, and leasing spreads were averaging 22% over the trailing 12 months. They were pretty acquisitive during the quarter. 19 new properties, $155 million. Another 23-property, $159 million portfolio they acquired shortly after the quarter ended in Q3. So that brings their post-spinoff acquisition pipeline to $750 million. That's well above their initial 2025 target pace of $125 million per quarter. Something to mention here is that cap rates on acquisitions averaged at 6%. There was some softening due to some intentional lease-up opportunities, but not due to market deterioration. Fairly limited market and management commentary on this call, but a few notes that I did want to call out. Management has spent a lot of this call talking about the long-term kind of fundamentals that are in favor of Curbline. They think they have some strong advantages relative to other retail formats. Faster leasing, lower turnover cost, much broader tenant pool. So they're effectively only focused on national tenants with good credit. Now, Curbline is targeting in their acquisition strategy long-term holds only. They have no disposition pipeline. Management cherry picks individual assets that align with their investment thesis. And this is one of the reasons that they've recently expanded into Dallas and the New York area. And interestingly, they do source both off and on market deals. So on the macro front, management and Curbline explicitly said they have not seen changes in tenant behavior or deal economics tied to broader macro concerns. That you can read that broadly as tariffs, because they argue that consumers are going to prioritize errand-based or essential retail. So they think this format is super resilient. So some similar themes to what you saw in your call there for Net Street, but I think a fundamentally different property type than some of the other retail formats we've covered on the call before. So Omar, I know that's the traditional four sectors, even if the companies themselves were a little different, but how does you remind folks what they're going to be in store for next week?
Yeah, as a reminder and reiterating what we kicked off the call with, these were just a few of the companies that we chose to focus on for the first half of REIT earnings, but we'll be back next week with more coverage and taking a more thematic approach, looking across sectors and across important topics that are being highlighted by other major REITs to really recap what these companies and management teams are experiencing and what they see for the second half of the year.
Omar, sounds excellent. I do think that's all the time we've got today. But before we sign off, I do want to encourage our listeners, as usual, if you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it. Give us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We will read them. Or feel free to just send us an email. We've got altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We would love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. But in the meantime, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.